This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's Janae Desmond Harris, aka Dear Prudence, and I want you to tell me about all your problems. Each week on Slate's Dear Prudence podcast, I'm here to tackle your questions about relationships, sex, work, family, and beyond, all with the help of an expert guest. We'll help you navigate it all, whether you're a teen dealing with parents, an adult looking to spice up your sex life, or you just need some validation that you're not losing it. We're here to listen and to offer some guidance. Need help? Just ask Prudy. New episodes every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray, welcoming you to the Woman's Hour podcast for Monday, the 9th of March. Good morning. 30 years ago, Naomi Wolf wrote a book called The Beauty Myth. She argued the pressure to be beautiful was a cultural conspiracy to keep women in their place. What's changed in 30 years? The BBC's Radio 6 Music Festival took place over the weekend, and last night, International Women's Day, there was an all-female lineup. We'll hear from one of the participants, the Mercury Award-nominated Nadine Shah. And as the races at Cheltenham begin, the women who ride, who want to be described as just jockeys as they compete alongside the men. Now, Jessie Ware used to be best known for her singing and songwriting. She is arguably now even better known in partnership with her mother, Lenny Ware, with whom she publishes a weekly podcast called Table Manners. The two women cook a Friday night dinner to which they invite a guest, Sam Smith, Ed Sheeran, Joe Brand and Paloma Faith, to name but a few. It's been going for 3 years and attracts millions of listeners. So popular has it become, they've now published a cookery book of the same title, Table Manners. Well, here, in the company of Sam Smith, whipped cream is a requirement.
Can I whip cream with a hand blender?
Hold on, Mum. Mum, we need whipped cream. This is going to be an issue.
Have you got a whisk?
I don't mind having non-whipped cream.
No, I mind.
How do you whip cream?
Have you got ice cream as well?
So this is an absolute mess, Mum. Hold on. I found a whisk.
Okay, well, that could take 20 minutes.
Oh, hold on. No.
That could take 20 minutes. Oh, my God, look at that whisk.
Should I just try and do it for a bit? Yeah. I mean, how long is it going to take?
A little while, darling.
Think of those arm muscles, babe.
No, haven't been able to work out for ages. I've just had one Pete Sampras-like bicep. Oh, no! Mum, it's already whipping!
Good.
Jessie, what prompted the idea of a podcast of Friday night dinner with your mother?
I think I was always so interested in other people's stories, and I was sick of talking about myself. Being in music, it's so self-involved and all-consuming about you. So I wanted to have conversations with other people, and I thought the best way of kind of having a conversation and not feeling like an interview was having my mum, who is the best host I know, the best cook I know, cooking for these guests and us sitting around the table and having a chat, which felt very informal and light, and talking about family and nostalgia and food memories. And some, I don't know what happened, but everyone seems to quite like it. And mum is the absolute star of the show.
Lenny, what was your response to the idea? Because it sounds to me as if it was assumed that you would be the cook.
It was. I was supposed to be in the background. I didn't know what a podcast was. I thought I was just cooking for Jessie to chat to friends, and I thought this would help her improve her interviewing process. And it just took on from there because I couldn't resist joining in with the conversation.
You never have been able to resist joining in with the conversation,
no.
I suspect.
I think that's right.
It does sound, though, Jessie, as if it's not always an easy ride. Mother, daughter, one kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about this before, and also in the book I talk about it, but Mum showed me tough love in the kitchen. She wasn't one of those ones that, you know, here's your penny, let's go and let's bake. It was, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, and I learned that way. But actually, I'm a pretty good cook from it, so thank you, Mother. But yeah, we're living together at the moment, which has been testing, but we're nearly out the end of it, and we've managed to make a podcast together and write a cookbook in that time. So and we're not killing each other, so it's all right.
I mean, there have been a couple of disastrous moments. The blowtorch moment when we
creme were trying, brulee with Hayley Squires. Yeah,
yeah.
What happened with the creme brulee?
Well, Jessie was using it too fiercely, I thought.
So I said,
I'll take over. And the whole blowtorch fell apart and set me on fire. Literally, I went up in flames.
She was okay,
fine.
Though. we never used the blowtorch again. It's okay.
We never used it again. It came apart, and Hayley Squires just couldn't believe her eyes. She was just us two arguing and then me going on fire.
What other disasters have you had?
Short ribs. George Ezra. They weren't short ribs. They were very long, and I marinated them for too long in wine, and they were tough as old boots. We had to get a Turkish takeaway, and it worked out all right, but we laughed so much. We laugh a lot. And I think even in these kind of catastrophic moments, we end up laughing, and that's just been how we've always worked, really.
How often have people asked you for the recipes? Because, I mean, now there's a book with all the recipes in it. Have people been saying, oh, that lovely
almost all the time, which is why we were approached to do a cookbook. So people kept on saying, gosh, that sounds delicious. Can I have the recipe? And in the end, we just thought we'll put them all together. And we've produced a cookbook, which I have to say is so easy. It's about easy cooking and just enjoying a lovely social time over a meal.
But how easy was it for you to write down recipes for food that you have been cooking for years?
That was tricky because it's all in your head and you do it by instinct. So actually writing the recipes down was tricky. So they were tested.
And tested again.
To make sure that they worked and they weren't just things that we could make work. So everyone's going to be able to make my chicken soup with matzo balls, I hope.
But wasn't there something, a recipe that you'd done and they couldn't make it work because you'd forgotten the eggs?
Yeah, the key lime pie. I had done it and, in fact, we made it for Cheryl.
Cheryl, yes, we did.
Cheryl?
Cheryl, well, she's called just Cheryl now, Cole.
As Mum is called Lenny now.
Cheryl. And I no one could make it work. So I said, well, I'm going to do it and I'll make it work. And I couldn't make it work. And then I realised I'd forgotten the eggs.
Quite simple.
Yeah. It's rectified.
They're in
now.
There, don't worry. Yeah. The eggs are in there.
What were your Friday night dinners like as you grew up?
Fun. I mean, they weren't kind of as you would imagine a Jewish household. You know, we lit the candles and then the rest kind of, it was Whitney Houston and dancing around the table. And it wasn't necessarily a full Jewish meal, but there was always the ask of chicken soup, wasn't there, and chopped liver. But we'd have all my friends from school who, you know, I grew up in South London. There weren't that many Jewish people there. So they'd come over with their parents and we'd have these lovely long dinners together that would end up with the singing and dancing at the end.
You admit in the book to being a food lover.
Yeah.
And your mother says your toes used to curl in your high chair.
Yes.
As the food was on its way. Mm. What do you love most of your mother's cooking?
She's the best with flavour. I mean, chicken soup, she'll taxi over to me when I'm ill, when I'd be losing my voice in a singing. Jewish penicillin, absolutely. But she's so good with flavour and just everything. I don't know, you've always been so brilliant. You've always, and also my children, we're living together and my children won't eat my food, but they'll always eat my mum's food. And I'm like, hold on, she's just done a roast the same as I, but there's something about my mum's cooking that...
I think there's always something about your mum's cooking. Yeah, maybe. That's always the best.
How did you learn? I mean, where did you develop your skills from your mother?
Yes. I mean, my mum was a good cook. I mean, a very conservative cook. You know, I was born 1951, so it was 5 years after the war. There wasn't that much around. When she first made spaghetti bolognese, I thought we were absolutely quite continental. And, you know, we didn't have things like broccoli or kiwi fruits or things like that. But now, she just was a very good basic cook. And I think I'm a very good basic cook.
No, Mum, you're better than that.
I think you're more inventive than
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, Mum.
And I've learned a lot from you because Jessie's brilliant at curries and adding spices. I'm not as confident.
As a single mother for much of the time, with a job as a social worker, how did you manage day after day after day to fit in good home cooking for the kids?
It's so important to me, eating and eating together. That was really important, that everyone sat down together at the end of the day and talked about their day and we ate together. So I plan. It's just good planning, really. I would cook in the morning something for the evening and know it was ready there and we could just warm it up and we'd eat together.
You'd come back from school and there would be the smell of food because she'd already have it ready.
It was ready.
Yeah.
So I think if you plan, it's easy. I think doing the podcast now, we're kind of planning all the time what we're going to cook for people.
But planning together, I mean, it's not entirely your responsibility now.
No, we do it together.
Absolutely.
How easy is it? This is probably a really stupid question because you're so famous anyway.
Oh, sure.
How easy is it to find your famous guests who are prepared to come to dinner on a Friday night?
Well, initially it was me going through my phone books. You know, we had Sam Smith on the first series, Clara Amford. Ed was on the second, but yeah, it was my friends. And now it's got a life of its own and people approach us. And so it's just, it's now a kind of, I don't want to call it a business, but you know, it's people want to be on it. So it's been...
And we're meeting more unusual people that we wouldn't have thought of before. And that's really interesting to meet new and different people from different walks of life.
Yeah, really. I think we're on series 10. I mean, it just keeps on going. And so it's amazing. We meet strangers, I'll bring... Yeah, so it's...
But you are now, Jessie, busy with the podcast, the book.
Yeah.
Another album coming soon.
Yeah.
Two children.
Yes.
I remember the last time I spoke to you, you were a little bit tired because you had a baby and you weren't getting much sleep. How are you coping now, fitting all this lot
in? I don't know what it is, but the more I've thrown at myself, the happier I am. I don't know. And I'm working with my mum and that's a very unique, beautiful situation. And the podcast has given me such a newfound confidence. And I have this music that's coming out that is just so fun. And my kids are amazing. It takes a village. My husband helps. We have a nanny 2 days a week. You know, it's a big old, everyone gets mucked in, mum helps. So yeah, that's how it works.
How surprised, Lenny, have you been at the success of the podcast?
Beyond my wildest dreams, really. I can't really measure the success, except that if I'm at the Tube and I say, oh God, the bloody Northern Line, someone says, are you Lenny from the podcast? I say, how do you know? Jessie says it's my whinging voice. But people recognise me on planes if I'm chatting. They'll say, are you Lenny from the podcast? It's so weird. So I know it must have a wide audience that people recognise my voice. It's very odd.
But how stressful is that then, to suddenly become famous after all these years?
It's very strange.
And to be cooking for all her famous friends.
It's very strange. I mean, it's you know, when it's someone like the wonderful Nigella Lawson, I mean, I think we planned for about 6 months, if she ever came on, what we cook. But meeting these wonderful people is just great. It's marvellous.
How much do you still enjoy cooking?
Let's say I'm not giving a... I used to give lots of dinner parties. That was my... I love it. But I don't give as many dinner parties. That's true. I tend to go out to eat and rather than cook.
Do you enjoy the cooking when you have to do it?
Yeah, I do. Mm. I enjoy being good at it. That's what I enjoy. Sometimes I get tired and my back hurts a bit if I've been at it all day and then I
moan. She complains a lot, but actually still delivers the best food ever.
I hope so.
So well, imagine what it would be if it was cooked with love.
Absolutely.
I mean, just imagine.
So it's not cooked with love at the moment.
It's pinches of love always go in my food.
Thank you both much, Lenny and Jessie Ware. And of course, the cookery book is out now and it's called, surprisingly, Table Manners. Thank you both
very much.
Now, the races at Cheltenham are due to start tomorrow and much will be made, no doubt, of the number of female jockeys. We reckon around 10. who'll be taking part, and the fact that last year three of their number, Bryony Frost, Rachel Blackmore and Lizzie Kelly, had significant wins. But there's a campaign to take the sex out of racing, a sport where men and women compete on an absolutely equal playing field. It's called hashtag Just Jockeys, and Lizzie Kelly is an ambassador for the change. Lizzie, what's prompted this campaign now?
Great British Racing put together this campaign after some really good stats came out about female jockeys and the rise of female jockeys. And I think after the festival at Cheltenham last year, it became quite apparent that female jockeys were probably doing better, you know, than they probably should have been. And I think that the time had come to really push that message forward.
How did that happen, that they were doing better than they should have been?
Basically, the stats read that the percentage of female jockeys winning at Cheltenham Festival last year was higher in comparison to the number of rides that they were getting in comparison to the males. So we were having more winners for the amount of rides, basically.
But how difficult has it been for women to be taken seriously as equal competitors?
I think that female jockeys have always been standout female jockeys back through the ages, whether that was G. Armitage, who rode Cheltenham Festival winners herself, or Nina Carberry and Katie Walsh. But I think the thing that's changed is the amount of female jockeys that are taking the plunge to turn professional and are seeing being a jockey as a viable career path, not something that's a hobby and they just do once in a while, you know, to actually make that choice that is your career. That has increased, I think, in the last sort of 5 years.
It seems to me that you always approached it as a potential career. What made you different?
I was very lucky that I was brought up in a yard myself. So my parents train racehorses, my stepdad and my mum. So for me, it was, you know, my life, really, riding racehorses from a very young age.
How young?
9, 10. Schooling over chase fences at home at 11 years of age. I think my mum was sort of a very, I won't say a pushy parent, but she was very much, if I wanted to do it, I had to do it properly. And although I never really planned, I never thought I could be a jockey, that was the main plan. So I sort of practiced as much as I could, you know, my whole childhood, really.
So not thinking you could ever be a jockey, where did that sense come from? That, oh, I'm a girl, they won't let me be a jockey, maybe?
Yeah, very much so. I was a girl and there weren't really any role models. It wasn't until I was sort of about 15, 16 that I really started to watch people like Nina Carberry and Katie Walsh. I mean, every girl needs, you know, a role model that's out there doing it, and they were my role models. And I think by the time I got to 21 and I'd left university, the options were to give it a bash or to sort of succumb to a life in an office. So I gave it a bash, thankfully.
Being very competitive is often celebrated in sportsmen. How much does that apply to women?
I think as a general rule, there are features for sportsmen that are positive, which for women aren't so positive. And I think that, you know, being competitive, being someone that's out there to do the best for themselves, I think in females can be seen, you know, as being bitchy or other negative connotations, you know. And I think the good thing about the fact that the female jockeys number is growing is that we're all the same sort of personalities, so very competitive and very much sort of trying to do the best for ourselves, and yet we're all very good friends. And I think that really helps, because it doesn't make you feel alienated. You know, if there's lots of us who are all trying to do the same thing and all trying to be competitive and all trying to be the best, it doesn't mean that you're not friends with each other. And I think it's a really healthy environment in the female jockeys changing room now, really healthy.
There was an all women event at Zafirwell yesterday for International Women's Day. And I wondered, how good an idea is that when you're actually looking to be seen as just jockeys?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because I personally felt it was quite contradictory. We have tried and tried and tried to push our message forward that we are as good as men. And obviously the Southall event gave more opportunities to female jockeys. But I certainly felt that it sent mixed messages, yeah.
I may be wrong about this, but what I've noticed in all of you young women jockeys, sorry, just jockeys, is that you're always immensely grateful to your horses. Every one of you, when you win a race, always say, no, it wasn't me, it was the horse. Is that different from the way men see it?
I don't think so. I think with all jockeys, our love of horses is the reason that we do it. You couldn't have that lifestyle. You couldn't have falls or not eat for 3 days to do a weight if you didn't really love horses. And I think once you strip back all the winners or all the falls or all the hours in the car driving to the races, you know, the main thing that we are all there for is because we love horses, we love riding in races. And I think that females just have a better way of pushing that forward. And perhaps we aren't trying to be too tough. I think the post-race interviews when females have won big races are more so about the emotion, whereas I think that the guys focus on the race itself, what happened in the race, and both are warranted, you know. Both a television viewer wants both, you know. Not everyone wants to hear me blabbering on about how wonderful he is, the horse that is. You know, some viewers want to hear, well, this happened at this point in the race. So I think both are needed.
Tip for Cheltenham, please. A top tip.
Other than yourself. I think that... if you really wanted a tip, that my tip is Silius Emery in the champion hurdle each way.
Lizzie Kelly, thank you very much for being with us, and the very best of luck to you this week as well. Now, still to come in today's programme, the beauty myth 30 years on. Naomi Wolf looks across those 30 years to discuss whether or not she achieved change for the better or the worse. And the sixth episode of the serial, Giuseppe de Lampedusa's The Leopard. It was, as I mentioned, International Women's Day yesterday, and one of the events to mark the occasion took place last night at the Roundhouse in North London. It was part of the BBC Radio 6 Music Festival and featured an all-female lineup. The poet, playwright and rapper Kate Tempest headlined the show, which included the composer Anna Meredith, Sonic Youth's Kim Gordon and Jenny Beth from Savages. Later in the week, you'll be able to download a Woman's Hour and Six Music podcast, including interviews with some of the best artists on the bill. Well, today it's Nadine Shah who began yesterday's performance. She also performed on Friday when she stood in at the last minute for the headliner Michael Kiwanuka. What was that experience like?
No, I was quite fearful of playing on Friday, because there's always that worry when an artist has to pull out of a show and then there's other people who come in to replace them, and then people, well, I didn't want to see so-and-so, and I wanted... The whole room was filled with love.
Who wants us, lady, to be a lady? Too careless, be careless. All he wants and fairness is a baby.
You've got a new record coming out. We should talk about the new track first. Ladies for Babies, Goats for Love. This is based on a brother's painting, right?
You tell anything to press. You tell anything, because I'm like, my press person's like, can you please like just write something serious about this song? And I'm like, ugh, have to give a PG version when it comes to radio and stuff. My brother did make a painting years ago of his friend naked embracing a goat with the words "Ladies for Babies, Goats for Fun" written upon it. And I guess because I must have been about 10 when he'd made this. So that stuck with me. And so when I'm writing an album and a lot of the songs are made up about, I'm talking about sexism, talking about tradition, talking about marriage and, you know, the ticking time bomb of childbirth and the policing of women's bodies and so on and so forth. That phrase came to mind when I was writing, because I think I was very aware with the last album being so, like, the discourse being so heavily political, but not being able to be playful with those lyrics because I was writing about the refugee crisis and writing about people who are displaced and truly suffering. And I'm not saying that women are not suffering in their own way, but I feel like as a woman, and I'm writing about my own personal stories, I'm then allowed to be jovial because they're my stories. And I'm talking about myself walking to a bus stop and getting harassed, like, verbally. But I think, you know, one of the worst things, we always talk about it often, is, like, what do bad men hate most? It's being laughed at. And so I do bring a lot of humour to the lyrics, so that's kind of why we have that in Ladies for Babies too.
The album is called Kitchen Sink, and I guess it's about that time in your life being observational when suddenly everyone starts having kids and the clock ticketh.
Oh, man.
Is the whole album like a reaction to that in a way?
No, not really. No, it's not. I mean, most of my female friends have children now, and I'm very respectful of their choices to have children, and I love their kids. I'm like an auntie to a bunch of weirdos now. Christmas is very expensive. But I do feel like a lot of my friends in my position in their mid-30s did need a woman their age, speaking of that similar frustration that they have, because so often we go onto social media and every day someone's getting married or somebody has some other significant thing happening in their life, which is more a traditional path, and a lot of us women haven't done that, and it does leave me feeling nervous and panicked. People will bring it up to me, like, people do actually say the phrase, like, TikTok, nearly 30, oh, you're 34 now, oh, time's running out, TikTok. People genuinely do say these things, and so I felt like women in my position did need some anthems to battle it.
But it's the kind of external pressure of, like, oh, you go to family parties, it's like, you're not married yet.
Mate, I'm half Pakistani, half Geordie. Imagine the pressure. It's like, it's way more.
We're all doing us and having a great time, and actually I'm looking around sometimes at my friends that are on the other side, and I'm like, nah, I think I'm all right.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I mean, I would hope that when the industry becomes better equipped, I hope it'll be a space where it'll be a much friendlier industry towards women who do have children, and to help women who do have children to facilitate their jobs.
Yeah.
At the minute, I don't feel like in my position I'd be able to bring a child on tour.
Because that is a big problem in the music industry. Massive. Women dropping off as soon as they have family, then they check out of the industry because it's not flexible enough and it's not easy enough to do it.
Yeah, exactly that. And with female artists as well, it's not having enough female artists present who are over the age of 40. Like in 2016, you had, three or four fellas who are 60 years old in the top 10. So they're visible, but a lot of these other women aren't so visible. Mm. But we have artists like Brick Smith's start, and we have Lucinda Williams, and we have Patti Smith, that we need more, though, to be visible in order that we can see that we can be it.
You can't be what you can't see. A phrase that's really being hammered home at the moment.
It's true, isn't it? I know it does sound tacky, it's like you can't see it, you can't be it. But it's entirely true. It's that sentiment. It's the same when I'd have like young Muslim girls getting in touch with me, being like, I didn't know I could. Yes, you can.
Yeah. In the time that you've been doing music, have you seen anything change? More women being around in studios, in technical positions, all that kind of thing.
Not a lot and not enough. The conversation's happening, and because it's happening, you assume that, things must be going on, things must be changing. They're not. They're seriously not. I found out what I was getting paid in comparison to other male artists who are my peers. But, you know, playing the same stages, same time, same festivals, and I was getting a third of what they were getting. And that's why I stopped being so shy about it. I knew it was crude to talk about money and crude to talk about certain things, but I just got so sick of it. I started openly asking fellow male musicians and fellow female musicians what their salaries were and what their frustrations were. And then there was this we connected on it, and it was like, oh, hang on, I've got that same problem. Well, why don't we both speak together, and we'll have so much more strength in this unity and this kind of power together. So I'm seeing that, and there's a lot more solidarity with other female artists coming together, whereas before we were kind of pitted against each other because female solo artists was a genre, apparently. I didn't know. and so it just meant, you know, there was only ever room for one woman. But that's been the same in so many industries. You know, we'll have to hire one. And so that makes women competitive, whereas we shouldn't be. And I can see so much solidarity. Like, if you see my guest list today, I got Gail Porter, Skin, Skunk and Nancy, and Brick Smith start. It's been so interesting talking to Gail Porter and hearing about her story, about what has happened to her within the music industry and in the media, the hostile environment she's been around. And her strength and what she's come through is just, it's awe-inspiring. Skin, who was one of the first people, did she headline Glastonbury one year? Remember, there was all that hoo-ha, and people were like, oh, who's the first person to first black artist to headline Glastonbury? And they'd just forgotten that Skunk and Nancy had done it.
Yeah.
And she's been an inspiration of mine and for so many people for years and years. And she's a brilliant, brilliant, powerful person, as is Brick Smith Start, who was in the Fall, who is still making albums. She's not just coming out playing Fall songs here and there. She's making these creative, beautiful dream works and is still like a gigging musician, you know. When this lineup was first announced, it didn't occur to me it was all female artists. I just thought, oh, it's loads of my favourites are playing, that'll be nice. And then it was pointed out to me that it was all females, which was an afterthought for me, actually.
Yeah. Because of Michael Kiwanuka not being able to play, all of the headliners over the whole weekend at the Roundhouse have been women.
And all ace.
You must have seen the discussion around festival lineups and festival representation for women off the back of the Reading and Leeds. Mm. Picture that went online again, 19 female acts of over 90 announced. What are your thoughts on all this?
This is the thing that I think so much pressure is put on the festivals themselves, and then radio DJs and artists and people who work in the industry point their fingers at the festivals, like, oh, you know, you've not done this. Well, maybe that radio station should start playing more females. Maybe that record label, they should start signing more females. And maybe these other artists should start forming alliances and helping out other females. So we can't just place the blame solely on festivals, because that's not going to actually make any change. We'll have to put more money into education in schools, because when I was growing up, you know, I was never really encouraged to play instruments as a child. It was like, she can sing really well, we'll put her in the choir. But the boys, they can go and do guitar and this over here. And even in toy shops, the instruments were in the boys' aisle. They weren't in the girls' aisle. So it wasn't really an option that you thought that was possible, actually. I was like, you could look nice and sing. There's no reason, for example, that 18-year-old boys shouldn't like my music, but they're not given it. Someone somewhere has made a decision, 18-year-old David isn't going to like this. Oh, but I think that, you know, that guy who's like in his 50s and that woman who's in her 40s, I think they'll like it. But that's you making an assumption of how people work. And I think the general public so often are underestimated. And that's where I think things go wrong. It's like, actually, if you give people good stuff, I think they're going to like it. Who's one of our biggest artists in the UK is Adele. And because she writes classically great, painful love songs, which are timeless and could, like, someone like you could have been written in the 50s. It's a gorgeous, timely song. But again, it was great and people picked up on it. And it wasn't to do with anything about how she looks, because she got rubbish for that. But it's the same conversation again. I think people just underestimate others too much.
Nadine Shah spoke to Georgie Rogers, and there are highlights of the festival, of course, on the BBC iPlayer. 30 years ago, a book was published called The Beauty Myth. In it, Naomi Wolf argued that the pressure to be beautiful, thin, youthful, small nose, big eyes, smooth skin and silky hair in order to make someone love us was what she described as a cultural conspiracy and the last best belief system that keeps male dominance intact. Well, 30 years on, what's changed? Are we less or more likely to buy into the myth. Naomi, what's the beauty myth for you of 2020?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for having me on Women's Hour. I am always so honored to be here. Well, I'm asked that a lot, as you can imagine. And generally, I say a lot of things have gotten better. Some things have gotten worse. Overwhelmingly, what's better is that I think most women are aware that these ideals are manufactured and they aren't nearly as internalized as they were 30 years ago. And that's huge because it's never really been about beauty, right? It's always been about how many of our life energies do these mythologies constrain and keep us from using elsewhere for revolution, really, and for our own ambitions and goals. But some things are considerably worse. I think that, well, social media is both really liberating for young women and men, but also adds a new kind of metric that, you know, those dopamine hits of likes and filters and perfection, you know, new way for images of perfection to replicate themselves. But also pornography, honestly, has really affected the last couple of generations growing up, because now it's very much part of how young people learn about human sexuality. And so these images are closer to their consciousness.
To what extent, though, is it still the last best belief system that keeps male dominance intact?
I don't think that's as true anymore, again, because I think so many women have seen through the quote-unquote ideal and understand, especially now with computer generation of images, you know, people understand that what they look at in a Chanel ad is not real life. It's not even how that model looks in real life. And there's so much more diversity, you know, again, with social media being empowering in many ways, so many more images that women and men can look at and say, well, I don't buy into that, or I'm not that color, I'm not that body type, I'm, you know, 65 years old or whatever it is, that's doesn't have to constrain me. So that's good. And as a result, I think that honestly, patriarchy is having a hard time finding new ideologies to enslave women with, because, and I talked about this last night, for the first time in history,
the Women of the World Festival,
which is so extraordinary. For the first time in human history, four generations of feminists are alive on the planet. And so there are four generations of boys and girls, men and women, who've been influenced by feminism. So I think patriarchy, it's not gone or evaporated, but there isn't a new ideology to take the place of the last waves of ideology to suppress women.
How much in 1990 were you directing your polemic at white women? And now how intersectional is your thinking on this question?
That is a very important question. I mean, I think in 1990, I certainly wasn't directing my polemic at white women. I was directing my polemic. I mean, I don't think any writer thinks I'm about to direct a polemic, right? You just say what you have to say. But I was speaking to everyone I wanted to. But I, you know, I am a white woman. And so I think in 1990, feminism among white women was not nearly as well informed about what a tiny subculture that is and how not the main discussion that is. And I think that one of the many positive things that have happened to feminism in the last 30 years is that, you know, the buzzword is intersectionality, but that's a hugely important concept. I think that people engaged in feminism, social justice generally, are much more aware that what happens to, you know, white middle-class people in the global north is not the whole story of humankind and is a tiny fragment of the stories of humankind. And especially with feminism, what's really going on that is news-breaking and critically urgent is happening in, you know, in the rest of the world with women's leadership in, you know, on many other continents than in the global north.
I remember 30 years ago, you put much of the blame for the beauty myth on women's magazines. And I wondered, what now is the impact of the whole wellness idea, the self-esteem idea, the you're worth it idea? To what extent has the advertising industry played into feminist concerns that actually, oh, it's my decision?
Tell me more about what you mean by that.
That if someone's saying in an advert, you're worth it, you might think, okay, yes, I'm a feminist. If I want to do it, I can do it. And yet it's still been a very powerful myth.
Yeah, honestly, I think that the way that mainstream advertisers talk to women now, I'll take it. Because I remember in the 1980s and early 90s, the magazines I was reading made their money, the advertisements made their money by demeaning women and insulting them and, you know, saying like, wrinkles are lesions. This was real language they used. Or that, you know, aging was a disease. And it was shaming. You know, the phrase body shaming is a recent coinage, but there was body shaming going on in the mainstream media. I mean, you and I, if we go back to those years, remember that. And I have to say, I love this country, but the British press is appallingly misogynist when it comes to body shaming, the shaming of older women. Extraordinary. So the fact that now that's not really, I mean, there's still misogyny in the British press, but advertisers,
I'm sure there's misogyny in the American press.
Certainly. It's different flavors of misogyny, absolutely. But advertisers now generally understand that women's self-esteem is higher and that they're not going to sell products if they insult women. So if they flatter women and cajole gently, you know, I think that's less damaging to women's self-esteem overall than this kind of constant barrage of insult and belittlement that you used to get from Madison Avenue.
So why still are so many of us obsessed with the way we look and feeling insecure about it? You hear it all the time.
I mean, I can't really answer that because, honestly, that's not my experience of the women that I'm in contact with, and maybe that's self-selecting. I mean, I think obviously everyone has their insecurity, but I think that those conversations honestly are vestigial. I mean, I think it's things people say as a kind of gesture of femininity. I don't know many older women who feel as bad about aging as women used to feel about aging. I know a lot of, I'm 57, I know a lot of women my age and older who feel super hot and badass, if I can say that on the air, you know, and are really excited about this stage of their lives and think they're awesome and they don't want to look 25. I know that, you know, women always have their days of feeling like, oh my God, I can't fit into my jeans or it's a bad hair day or whatever. But I don't feel like I don't know many women now who feel that that determines their worth in the same way. It's like the weather, you know, a cloud can cross the sun, but it doesn't determine the outcome of what you do that day.
What about young men? To what extent are they buying into a beauty myth?
Well, now, Jenny, now you're talking because, you've been talking, but this is a very important subject. In the beauty myth, I did foreshadow that the male body would be colonized by advertising. And for sure, men, and this is in the last 15 years, have been targeted by advertisers to feel some of the insecurities that women have traditionally felt. And so you do see a rise in eating disorders among boys. In America, there's abuse of steroids among boys who want that perfect six-pack, those perfect, biceps and definition. And a lot of young men are talking about their insecurities around their bodies. And I don't think that that's a step forward. On the other hand, it is kind of healthy for feminism that men and women recognize that there's common cause in resisting the kind of commodification of their bodies and minds that capitalism likes to do to people.
I was talking to Naomi Wolf. Lots of response from you on the question of table manners and Jessie Ware and Lenny Ware and their new cookbook of recipes from their podcast. Di emailed, as a woman of a certain age, I'd never heard of these two ladies, but I'd picked up a recipe pull-out in a weekend newspaper supplement. I cooked marbella chicken on Saturday evening for 10 friends. It was amazing, and I received so many compliments. Coincidentally, my daughter Harriet was at a boyfriend's that night who also served marbella chicken, which was also fantastic. Edward is a keen listener to the podcast and, as a foodie, is a big fan. How wonderful to hear Jessie and Lenny on your show today. I'll listen to their podcast now to pick up more recipes to wow our friends. And Jane, who emailed us from Paris, said, I tuned in today when I saw table manners on your content list, thinking that this was going to discuss table manners. Watching young people eat in restaurants these days, I have noticed that all that I learned as a child must no longer be the norm, and that what I consider to be a polite way of eating in the company of others has gone the way of many other ways of behaving in public. Dorothy Van Coolwick on Just Jockeys, I was talking to Liz Kelly, said it's quite simple. All male sports need to be classified as open, meaning opening to both sexes as well as anyone with a gender identity. May the best win. Women's sport, on the other hand, remains restricted based on sex for very, very obvious reasons. And then on Naomi Wolf and the Beauty Myth, Sue Green said, so relevant. I know so many women, young women, who are having Botox and all those other, what I would call invasive, but not sure of the names, where they have the top layer of their skin scraped, that sort of thing, procedures. And Hannah McDowell said, I long for the day when women and men can feel good about their age, whatever that is, and however it affects their bodies. I think ageism awareness is shockingly low, especially ageism about ourselves and our older selves coming up. Now, do join Jane tomorrow when we'll be continuing the series on friendship and the role it has in different women's lives. She'll be discussing the power of the digital sisterhood, the friends you meet online who apparently can protect you from online abuse. That's tomorrow morning, 2:02. Join Jane if you can.
It's Janae Desmond-Harris, a.k.a. Dear Prudence, and I want you to tell me about all your problems. Each week on Slate's Dear Prudence podcast, I'm here to tackle your questions about relationships, sex, work, family, and beyond, all with the help of an expert guest. We'll help you navigate it all, whether you're a teen dealing with parents, an adult looking to spice up your sex life, or you just need some validation that you're not losing it. We're here to listen and to offer some guidance. Need help? Just ask Prudy. New episodes every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.